Hello. I'm Harrison Salisbury. Welcome to Behind the Lines. Today we're out in the heart of the Colorado Mountains, although there's so much snow you can't see them very well. We've come out here to talk to Hunter Thompson. We're talking about something that people call the new journalism. Hunter calls it gonzo journalism. We're going to sit down with him and see what it's all about. Hunter, you started out, I believe, as a sports writer. And then you went to Latin America, and you were a correspondent there for a while for the National Observer. And then you finally came to something that you call gonzo journalism. And you've done that mostly for Rolling Stone, I think, as sort of a national correspondent for them. Is that right?
Yeah.
What is gonzo journalism, and why do you call it that?
That word has really plagued me, because first I realized I was doing something different. Just at some point, really, for Scanlon's magazine rather than Rolling Stone, even before Rolling Stone. But I wasn't really in this country when the new journalism sort of began. And I wasn't sure I was doing that. But I was sure I wasn't doing, what we call straight journalism.
Right.
And after I'd done a story in the Kentucky Derby for Scanlon's, a friend of mine who had covered the New Hampshire primary with me in 68, who's from Boston, and I'd recall him using this word gonzo in a sort of indefinable kind of way, as kind of nice, crazy, like, zing, gonzo. He wrote me a note saying that derby piece was pure gonzo. I thought, well, if that's what it was, I thought it was a brutal failure. I'd botched my assignment, I had to start ripping notebooks pages out of my notebook and feeding them into the Mojo Wire and sending them to San Francisco right to the printer out of the notebook. I regard it as one of my worst failures. And I got this onslaught of mail. Mail called saying I made a great breakthrough in journalism. I thought, well, Christ, if I made it, this breakthrough, we got to call it something. I mean, why call it, another word that's been used? So I just liked the word gonzo, and it seemed to mean what I was doing. Kind of, there's a mixture of humor and kind of a high stomping style in it, bit more active than your normal journalism.
It's got a great sound, that word gonzo.
Yeah, I'm a word freak. I treat words like music. I like that.
When I read Hell's Angels, which is the thing that really put your name up in lights, as it were, this really wasn't gonzo journalism, was it? As far as the writing is concerned, this is straight, factual, hard-hitting reporting.
But there are pieces of gonzo in there that I didn't realize until I went back.
Right, yeah. But when you were writing this, you were writing it like you would... not like you'd perhaps would have written it for the National Observer, but the style is so different from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, for example, which is...
Well, that was pure gonzo now.
Yeah.
That was, I can't dance too much, but, that's my form of dancing. That was just a straight act. The Vegas is my favorite book because it's such a tight, hard... It's an exercise in writing. This was more journalism. And I think... maybe what I discovered in that was being the first book I'd ever written. I never had that much room.
Yeah.
And I never had that kind of space that would allow you to let your mind wander and, what if.
Yeah.
And that's all that makes... That's pretty grim stuff, having lived with those buggers for a year and a half. You need a little break, and if you have to create it yourself at 5 in the morning, just to have some fun. I hate to write, normally. I really despise the work. And all I can really get off on is things like that. When I can let my mind run, I start to laugh.
Right.
I understand that Dickens used to laugh at his typewriter.
Yeah.
I don't laugh at my typewriter until I hit one of those, what I consider a pure gonzo breakthrough. Then it's worth it, all the work.
Sometimes I have the impression when you're, from your writing, that your typewriter is an enemy, and it's a struggle as to which one's going to come out on top.
No, what I've finally figured out, I've been asked what gonzo means for so long, that I'm forced into at least a pretense of finding a serious definition. And what I went to Vegas to do, actually, when I realized I was going to do a book out of it or a long article, what I've been trying to do for a long time was to to eliminate the steps or the blocks between the writer and the page. That's why I always get the fastest and newest typewriter. If they make one that costs $12 million, I'll write a bad check and get it for a while. And you know, it's the steps between what you're thinking and what you want to put on the page.
Isn't intense personalization a characteristic of Gonzo journalism? And that is not only your intense personalization of the story as you write it, but your intense participation. You're right in the middle of the action yourself, which is something which the ordinary newspaper man or journalist is not. He stands aside.
Well, that's the difference. That's what when I was forced to make a distinction between Gonzo and what Tom Wolfe calls new journalism, that was the first and most obvious one that came to mind. That people like Tom and, say, Gay Talese or whoever else, I never understood what new journalism was. When Tom was writing his book, I asked him several times to send me something to tell me what it really meant. Because I'm included in the book, I still, I don't know. But it seemed like that was the most obvious difference, that they go back and recreate situations. Whereas I'm either too lazy or incompetent or something. I can only get into a story when I'm right there, which makes for a problem sometimes.
Well, I couldn't help, and I think many people probably have compared you with Tom Wolfe because you're both very strong as far as style is concerned. He has a different style from yours. But to me, it seems that Norman Mailer is closer to you because he gets involved in the story just as you do.
Well, I remember in August of 68, when Mailer was writing about Chicago, I was there.
Yes.
And I was researching a book that I've never done. And I was at the corner of Michigan and Balboa at 7:30 when Reverend Abernathy let his mules off, and I was right smack in the middle of it.
Yep.
And Mailer was at a cocktail party, you know, two blocks away, which is not to take nothing away from Mailer at all.
No.
Because I think he's broken ground for a lot of people. I mean, Mailer was really an icebreaker for me and Wolf. He deserves a tremendous amount of credit for having had the balls to go ahead and plow his own ground. And if there is somebody who really, in this century anyway, say since Stephen Crane or people like that, in our time, Mailer really has plowed the ground that I think we're sort of trying to define now. Wolf in his way, me in mine, other people in theirs.
Then we have another thing in journalism that I've noticed, and I know you have all our careers, and that is that sports reporters have a special quality that they inject into reporting: style, a color, a philosophy, which the mainline reporters don't have. It goes back as far as people like Hemingway and Ring Lardner.
I was going to say, if you give me some examples, that's pretty heavy to spring on me there. Well, you want to explore maybe a reason or two for that?
Yes, I'd like to.
I think two come to mind right away. One would have to do with, you have to assume you're dealing with writers rather than reporters, which
yes.
I make a very, very strong distinction between, rather than journalists and novelists, say. And sports reporters are used to being lied to. They're used to, especially young ones, they see the people older than they are and the sort of heavies in the field accepting it. And the best of it makes angry. And that's one reason. You come in with what's Hemingway's phrase? The most valuable tool a writer has is a foolproof bullshit detector. That's not right, but it's just about...
Yeah.
Just about right. And sports reporters, sports writers, with the obvious exceptions, there may be one or two, no, they're being lied to. It's a whole horrible con job. And you either accept it or you don't. I chose not to. So that's one reason. And so you come into any other kind of politics with a background of being con all the time and of having gone along with it a little bit, maybe, and maybe not, or when you didn't, getting punished for it. So you come in a little angry. And the other thing is that sports writing has such a... This is where you get the distinction between writers and reporters. You get... In sports writing, the opportunity to use verbs and adjectives naturally that would never come up in political writing or even general reporting. I remember I used to edit two papers at the same time in Florida. And I would have a hell of a time with several football games on one weekend running the headlines. You know, the Eagles would squash somebody, and the Penguins would rip somebody, and somebody else would stomp somebody. And there's a great sense of kind of presence in sports writing. You know, you want the feeling of the grass, you know, the atmosphere of the crowd, the tension, the excitement. You get a tremendous leeway with the usage of words. You know, where you have to weigh your meanings and that sort of thing in political reporting. You don't have to in sports writing. But in fact, the wilder you get, the better it is.
Right. That's right. Well, what about your style? What about Gonzo journalism? When it comes to these intensive, investigative stories, the sort of thing that was typical of Watergate, how do you cope with that kind of thing? Or can you really cope with it in Gonzo journalism? Don't you have to have somebody out there doing the digging first?
Yeah, one of the great ironies of my life is that I was in the Watergate the night that they broke in.
You were?
I was in the bar with Tom Quinn, a sports columnist for the now defunct Washington Daily News. And we'd been swimming downstairs. There were only two places in Washington I could stand. One was a Watergate pool, and the other was a hillbilly bar called the Shamrock, which is now closed, which gives me even more reason not to go back. But I can kind of excuse myself for not... I'm not in the habit of going to every place and looking for tape on the locks and every, you know, particularly big hotels. But being a one-man staff, really, at the time, not every two, but... No, at that point, there really one. Tim Krause hadn't really come in yet. And, or if he... No, he had, but he'd gone off on his press book. So, now you really have to have a staff. You have to have... Oh, I remember even Carl and Bob, when they were first putting it together, they had, a veteran police reporter who had a note of some sort, who knew something. You really have to have... You can't do that kind of saturation investigative reporting. Now, you might do it once if you really stumble on, if you find a thread you can pull on.
I remember that...
Cy Hirsch does that.
Cy does. He does it as a one-man band. I don't know how the dickens he does it.
I don't either, man. He's damn good.
Somehow or other, he manages to do it. But I remember you were talking with...
He's
Tony.
Mean.
Yeah. That's true.
That's one of the main qualities of...
Yeah.
Of, I think, honest...
Yeah.
I consider myself honest, though I might be a little bit weird. I think meanness is a very critical quality.
When you were covering the McGovern campaign, did you have a premonition that something was going wrong, there was something deeply wrong with the campaign?
I seen the energy go out of it. You know, when you're driving a car very fast, you can feel it when it peaks out. You know, no matter how heavy your foot is, you can't make it go any faster. And then it starts to, unless it's perfectly tuned, it'll start to sputter, and that's what was happening. And I was trying to find out why, because I was very concerned about it.
Yep.
I've had a visceral, personal hatred for Nixon for as long as I can remember. I was losing my perspective at that point.
Yeah.
But
you have to keep a perspective in Gonzo journalism just as in any other kind, don't you?
Well, I don't know. I think my final refusal to write the October article, which ended up about this long, the title was For Whom the Bell Tolls.
What was that? I'm not familiar with that.
It was my coverage of the Nixon... It was sort of the wrap-up.
The
last piece before Election Day.
Mm-hmm.
And they had five pages open for it, and they're all waiting, you know, art ready to go. And I sent them at the last second. I sent them a portrait by a friend of mine in town. Might even be up there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sent them that. Re-elect the president with a death's head.
Yes.
And about 500 words, which I still consider to be probably the most cogent 500 words ever written on the campaign. Just saying, I was so disgusted that, you know, with the country and with the campaign that I couldn't write. I didn't feel like writing. I was going to vote for the first time in a presidential election for a major candidate since 60. Or I wouldn't vote at all in 64. I voted for Dick Gregory in 68. And I wrote that as an epitaph, really, for the campaign. I knew, you know, it was all over. I was very depressed. And I had no idea what was coming. If I had, I probably would have spent Election Day out here just rolling in the yard laughing.
Yeah.
It didn't take them long. It was within 6 months they were up to their neck. And,
that's right.
And swill.
Had you gotten... You didn't have any feeling from the Watergate stories that had appeared at that time, that anything like this...
Yeah, I knew. I knew that things were... That there was a story I should be on.
Yes.
But this time, Tim Krause was working on his press book.
Yes.
And the campaign had entered its sort of terminal stages. And that was the first time Rolling Stone had ever even attempted to cover anything except music or anything directly related.
Yeah.
So we just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And thank God, you know, Bradley and Pearl and Bob and Sussman and those people had enough sense to keep running that story.
That's right. That's right. But I think probably you would agree with me that there is a small, or maybe a large incompatibility between Gonzo journalism and this kind of factual digging, putting, you know, it's like a crossword puzzle getting it all together.
I think that's where you get that disparity between the writer and the reporter.
Yeah, that's
right. If you can, you know, if you accept that, then there's no need to talk about new journalism or Gonzo journalism.
That's right. But you sort of start off where they leave off, isn't that right?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but that's really, it occurred to me about halfway during the campaign that people actually believed a lot of the things I was writing about, you know, Muskie eating this strange Brazilian drug, and I assumed that everybody else was getting their coverage, just like, you know, they need their basic coverage, like I do, out of the, you know, papers and TV. And about halfway through the campaign, I realized that, my God.
This has been one of your problems, hasn't it? That people don't understand when you're putting them on.
That's been a problem a lot longer than most people realize, I think. Maybe even longer than I realize. I'm not even sure myself anymore.
Well, I wondered a little bit in reading back to all the things, or not all the things, but an awful lot of the things that you've written, and then a lot of things that have been written about you, whether sometimes you weren't a little bit like the CIA agents, that you lived your cover.
I'll give you that one, yeah.
Yeah?
Not all the time, but...
Not all the time, but...
I have to.
You get a lot of fun out of it, don't you?
Oh, if I didn't, I wouldn't do it. You don't go out and just break yourself down to jelly.
Right.
On that campaign trail, but, you know, when publishers, I think I made $10,000 off that, you know, that whole thing. Yeah, there has to be, there's a high in covering politics. I think it's a combination of power and adrenaline, which beats any drug I've found yet.
Yeah.
When it's not fun, you stop.
Right.
I mean, there's not enough time. We're all getting old.
Yeah.
I have no intention of doing things I don't enjoy anymore. Unless, of course, I'm forced to.
Will you be covering the next campaign?
I'm not sure yet, because I have a fear that you can't do something new and right, you know, twice.
Yeah.
Publishers always want you to go back and do sort of a repeat in a different, you know, like Son of Hell's Angels, Son of Las Vegas,
that's
that sort
right.
of thing.
That's right.
And I think if you've done something right once, you should move on to something else. Well, I'm not sure what it's going to be. I have a novel I'm supposed to finish right now.
You finished a novel?
Yeah, if I could write novels, I wouldn't. Yeah, I would. I'm kidding myself. I'm a political junkie. And nobody wants any political coverage right now. People are convinced it's going to be a Jackson Ford race, a very dull race. People are sort of dulled out after Watergate and Nixon. I don't think so. I think we're going to have a really interesting race this time.
Hunter, it seems to me that almost everything you write is permeated with a sense that time is running out, or maybe has run out already, a strong sense of inner tension as far as you're concerned. Do you think it's possible for you to write without that that very strong tension?
You just hit on a very sensitive point, because I've been told by at least one or two competent specialists that the kind of tension I maintain cannot be done for any length of time without I'll either melt or explode, one of the two. Or just wither up one day.
Yeah.
I never tried it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think I'd probably write differently, yeah. Or I might get on different subjects. A book like Vegas, even that, you know, which appears to be humor, is really extremely tight.
Yeah.
That's the one book of mine that I've even read. I haven't read the other two. Because I know that's four or five rewrites. And there's not a word in there. I mean, there might be 15 or 20. But they're... That's about all. We don't have to be there. And I'm not sure just where the tension comes from. It's whether, you know, it could be drug-induced or adrenaline-induced or time-induced. That, I think, was because I wanted to write it just like that. Maybe I could. I guess I'm going to have to find out.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But when you're writing something like that, don't you feel yourself in the grip of that kind of fear that you're writing?
Oh, I don't sleep. I have to get my mind right into what I'm writing about. I have to stay there.
Right.
That's why I have to write at night.
Yeah.
Because during the day, if I try, there's always something. Phone calls, people in the driveway. I tried writing on the porch in the sun. I tried writing in here. But I have to have time to drift into that kind of mindset and be there.
What about the drug culture? There's an awful lot in your books about drugs, and you talk about taking them yourself all the time. Is this essential to the time you're living in, or is it something personal with you?
I think it was for a while in San Francisco in the middle 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And to understand that and to be a part of it and to be accepted and to write about it, which is not to say that's why I did it. I did it because it was fun. I never really thought of myself as either a spokesman for or as a part of the drug culture, although a lot of other people do. I have to be a person who does most things to excess. And so it just would, you know, be normal that I'd do it with drugs. I'm pretty selective, and I've learned a lot.
Yeah.
And maybe I've burnt my mind up. Maybe I've gone crazy. Maybe I've destroyed myself. But it doesn't worry me too much right now.
Seems to me you have a remarkable facility to create for the reader the feeling of what it's like to take a drug or to take a combination. It's usually a combination.
That's what the Vegas thing was intended to do. I was thinking of it in terms of, in visual terms, as a screen thing.
Yep.
After 5 years of living in it, I realized that nobody had conveyed that feeling, and
well,
I'm not sure that does.
A couple of other people have tried to do it, and I'm not talking about contemporaries. I'm thinking about Confessions of an Opium Eater. I don't know if you ever read it or not. And some of Coleridge's things, which were written either supposedly or possibly when he'd experienced the use of opium and various drugs. But the images that come through from their writing are totally different from yours. The factor that comes in yours, to me at least, is this factor of tension. They often have these sort of beatific, I don't know how you pronounce it, dreams, and they go off into marvelous fantasies, but your fantasies have an element of terror in them always.
Well, that's because, for one thing, I tend to favor drugs that increase the intensity of any experience.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been really a fan of crass or any kind of downers.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried heroin once or twice. That interests me at all. I like anything that intensifies the experience, and sometimes you can go a bit too far. Then you get real terror.
Yes.
And but once you live through that, you've gone to the bottom of your mind, and there's nothing there that's going to, you know, no horrible animal's going to come out and, you know, frighten everybody around you and embarrass you tomorrow. I was told for years that I was too violent to eat LSD.
Mm-hmm.
And I was basically a violent person, and all these people liked me and could get along with me on occasion. That under no circumstances should I ever touch that stuff. Because it really robs you of all your defenses. Whatever you're going to do, you're going to do. There's no, like junkies talk about smack. There's a phrase called walking with a king. You know you're on a different level.
Did you ever read William Thompson's Edge of Consciousness? Are you familiar with that at all?
No.
It's interesting, and I think you'd like reading it, because Bill Thompson has a theory that writers like yourself and poets, particularly and artists, people who have intense consciousness, really are capable and do in what they see and what they feel and experience something which lies ahead in the future. They really are in the future. If you want to know what the future is, you go to people of this kind.
That's weird.
What do you see of the future of the world and the country? Is there going to be more violence, or are we on the crest of a wave, or maybe even passed over that tremendous wave of violence that marked this country in the late 60s and the early 70s?
I don't think this country can afford that kind of violence anymore. Violence is really a luxury.
Yeah.
You learn that after you've been in it for a while. I used to like to get in bar fights, and, you know, I was sort of an apparently violent person. I didn't like to hurt people or... well, there's a difference. And I found out what the difference was when I first began to go around the Hell's Angels.
Yes.
I saw violence there that I had never even thought about. Really mean, ugly violence. And the kind of violence I used to get into, you know, was a luxury, and I realized that.
Hunter, we've been talking a lot about journalism and where it's going, what the future may have ahead for us. Do you think that gonzo journalism has a future? Is that where it's going to go?
I don't think... I would kind of hope, in a way, that gonzo journalism wouldn't have much future beyond where I take it. And I might end it tomorrow. As I've said, it was really a convenient word to separate me from something I knew I wasn't doing, and yet also to keep I want to emphasize the word, respectful difference from the new journalism.
It's a spirit then, really, rather than a style.
Yeah, it's, I read something really nice last night in, about breaking rules. It was in one of these pieces, on New South, I think. I can't quote it perfectly, but it said that it spoke of a tradition of when you go against taboos, you bring a combination of humor and seriousness to it, which opens a few more doors than if you bring a sledgehammer. Of course, you can go through the door first with an ice pick, and then, you know...
then you explode.
I don't do that often. I very seldom really get on somebody violently. I did on Nixon, and I'm very proud of it. I'm especially proud that I got on him long before he went down. I kicked him when he was still up. Occasionally, I'll make a mistake. I don't like to hurt people, but if you're going to have to deal in this world, which is occasionally pretty rough, you're going to hurt somebody, usually by accident, you may as well hurt the right people. And that's a value judgment.
That's pretty good.
I mean, if I'm wrong, well, I'm going to suffer for it.
Hunter, thank you very much. I'm afraid we're going to have to bring this pleasant conversation to an end. It's been particularly nice talking to you here up in the mountains with the snow coming down and closing in and sitting by your fireplace in a little part of America that's all your own. For a transcript of this program, please send $1 to Behind the Lines, WNET 13, Box 345, New York, New York, 10019. The preceding program was produced under the supervision and control of WNET, which is solely responsible for its content. This program was made possible by a grant from the Martin Wiener Foundation and by a general program grant from the Ford Foundation.